Hi, folks. Today I'm speaking to a very important person who is a fellow resident of Comboyne called Ken Henry. He was the Treasury Secretary under Peter Costello and Paul Keating, and then he was the Chairman of NAB. And now he's involved in this incredible, accountancy project called Accounting for Nature, which is part of this whole sort of movement worldwide to actually put an economic value on nature so that, one, we can meet our climate change targets, and two, we can preserve a bit of diversity, and three, we won't destroy the planet. So hello, Ken.
Well, hello, Margot. It's good to be with you.
So you're back from last week's inaugural Nature Positive Summit, hosted by the New South Wales and federal governments. What is all that about?
Well, it's actually quite an important project, and there were about 1,000 people there from all over the world. 1,000 people are committed to turning around the destruction of nature that has underwritten economic and social progress in most of our countries for some hundreds of years now, in some countries, of course, for a good deal longer than that. And these are people who have come to the realization that it's no longer possible for us to continue to pursue economic and social progress by degrading nature, that we can no longer extract prosperity from the natural environment, that we have to instead start to rebuild a good part of what has been lost. People, I think, have understood for some years now that that's part of what's going to be required to deal with the carbon challenge, to deal with climate change, that we are going to have to turn around a long history of environmental destruction and allow nature and the natural environment to store more carbon. I think that people are aware of that. The nature positive element is a more recent development, with people, as I said, all over the world now realizing that at the same time as we are addressing the carbon challenge, we have to also address the loss of biodiversity, the loss of vegetation across our landscapes, the loss of intact ecosystems, the loss of habitat, and so on. We've got to do it all, and we've got to do it now.
So I'm assuming from that we go, okay, in the way our economic system works, Australia and worldwide, you've got to put a money value on nature.
I know that sounds like a challenging concept. We may never have to do that precisely. But what we do have to do is we have to measure what is happening to nature. Yeah. And then we have to use market mechanisms to enable people, businesses mainly, but governments also, to invest in nature. Now, you could, at some stage, somebody will be able to connect the dots and say, oh, well, it turns out that if you invest, $1 billion, let's say, in this piece of nature repair, you get an improvement of 20%, and they might say that therefore we can figure out how much the whole 100% is worth. I mean, I don't know. I think the important thing, you don't have to connect those dots. I think the important thing is that, as I said, people have a financial incentive to improve environmental condition, whereas in the economy that we operate in today, the incentives are very much the converse, right? All the incentives, all the commercial incentives that are in the system now reward people for destroying nature, not for rebuilding nature.
Yeah, I noticed Tanya Plibersek was talking about a nature repair system. Presumably that's about if you if you do a lot of work on that, you get a tax deduction or you...
No, it's not a tax deduction. So what she has, what the Australian government has done over several months now is progressively introduce into the Commonwealth Parliament pieces of legislation that will make it easier for those who want to buy and sell instruments that reflect environmental condition, make it easier for them to do so. She introduced into the Parliament some time ago now a nature repair bill, and that's been legislated, the Nature Repair Act, and it sets out a legislative framework for landholders to generate something called nature repair certificates if they undertake nature repair activity on their properties. Now, the thinking is that there will be buyers for those nature repair certificates. And in due course, there will be. There's a lot.
Why would you buy it though, Ken?
Yeah,
is it like a carbon offset thing or a...
Well, actually, no. So interestingly, the legislation prohibits these certificates being purchased as offsets. But offsets has a very special meaning, right?
Yeah.
So an offset would exist where a developer, for example, so it might be a residential or commercial piece of development, a developer has to purchase offsets to compensate for the environmental damage that their development is causing, right? And so, for example, there is a very elaborate biodiversity offset scheme operating in New South Wales. It's probably the most elaborate scheme in the world, in fact, which deals with and sets out the ways in which developers have to offset the environmental damage that they're causing through their residential commercial development. The use of nature repair certificates for that purpose is actually prohibited in the Commonwealth legislation. So the more likely use of these nature repair certificates is that you will have either philanthropists or businesses saying, look, I don't have an obligation under law to offset the environmental damage that I'm doing. I don't have a formal requirement to do that, but nevertheless, I want to do it. Like I want to make a contribution to the repair of the natural environment. I think that's where the interest is at the moment. Now, obviously, not all businesses have an interest in being able to say that, but it appears that some do, and I think increasingly over time we will find businesses wanting to fund nature repair for a variety of reasons, not because they're required to do so by law, but because they see it as a sensible thing for their business to be seen to be doing. And so in time, I expect we will see a market for these certificates. The other opportunity though, Margot, and it's actually a very, very big one, is to think about the way that you might want to integrate carbon or climate change policy and nature repair. It sounds so obvious, and it really is obvious, but we have not done it. Going back to the comment I made before, right, that if we're going to meet our climate challenge, we're going to have to use nature to sequester a lot more carbon than it presently does. We need to be asking ourselves this question: in what form would we like to see that carbon sequestered in the Australian landscape? Now, just to put some numbers on it, and it's quite these numbers are quite big. According to the Climate Change Authority, if you ignore carbon emissions from agricultural activity and other uses of the Australian landscape, the Australian landscape itself sequesters or draws out of the atmosphere something like 90 million tonnes of carbon a year. 90 million tonnes.
So that's forests, is it, basically?
Well, it's mainly forests, but it's actually all forms of vegetation across the landscape. Yeah. So, you know, even things that some people might refer to as woody weeds, they're nevertheless drawing carbon out of the atmosphere, right? But grasses too, savanna grasses in particular, sequester a lot of carbon. Matter of fact, the best natural sequestration of carbon occurs in peatlands, you know, in under wetlands. These are not found all over Australia, but they're certainly found down on the coast to the east of where you and I are, Margot. There's peatlands down. You might remember 5 years ago they were burning, and they burned the one near the airport at Port Macquarie burned, I think, for more than 12 months because it had dried out. But it's peat, and when it's in good condition, it's the best storage of carbon that we know of. I mean, it's absolutely spectacular. So that's one form. Now, you know, if the Australian landscape is presently sequestering, let's say, 90 million tonnes of carbon a year, we should ask ourselves, well, if Australia is to meet net zero by 2050, and that is a commitment that the Australian government has and also the opposition, so it's bipartisan. If that is to be achieved, how much is the Australian landscape going to have to be sequestering by 2050 and in every year between now and 2050? Yeah. The Climate Change Authority report released just about a month ago suggests that by 2050, the Australian landscape is going to have to be sequestering maybe a third again, as much as it sequesters today. And I've seen a lot of numbers that are a lot higher than that, that, you know, maybe the Australian landscape will have to be sequestering maybe 200 million tonnes of carbon a year. Now, that in the minds of some people I know, that appears as a challenge. But in my mind, that's an extraordinary opportunity, right? Because those landholders who find ways of sequestering carbon on their properties, they're going to get paid for it.
Yeah.
This is another source of income presently not available to most landholders across Australia. And we're talking a lot. Modelling that an organisation that I chair has commissioned suggests that through this process, if we cleverly combine the carbon and nature repair tasks, that we should be able to get the carbon markets to generate easily $10 billion a year, $10 billion a year in nature repair across the Australian landscape. Yeah. And that would be truly transformative.
Now, I just want to go back away, because I just went into shock when you said that the New South Wales government has an elaborate scheme to insist that developers offset the environmental damage.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sorry, but New South Wales State Forests are ripping through our native forests and destroying our biodiversity. So I've just got the question, how are they offsetting that, Ken?
No, they're not. And they're
exempt. So it's a complete crap.
They're exempt from the scheme. Yeah. Okay, so the biodiversity
complete
offsets.
And utter crap. And I notice that Penny Sharp, the New South Wales Environment Minister, New South Wales government co-hosting the Nature Positive Summit, didn't turn up. I wonder why.
Yeah, well, I don't know why, but I don't want to comment on that, Margot. But
no, of course not. You know, but I guess, come on.
Yeah, I know. I was myself struck by the dissonance between. Between all of the discussion about the importance of nature positive and the fact that, well, I know maybe not quite as well as you, Margot, because of your recent experience, but I nevertheless yes. know very well what's going on
yeah.
in the state forests of New South Wales, including the Bulga State Forest. And, you know, I found myself sitting on stage in plenary session at the Global Nature Positive Summit, couldn't help but be challenged by that dissonance, that what we were talking about just does not sit well with what we see happening around us in 2024 in the state.
So you're saying they're exempting themselves from their own environmental offset scheme?
Yeah, the Native Forest Estate in New South Wales is not subject to that same scheme. No.
Yeah. Now, the last time I met you, we were on a spotlight in the forest, spotlighting trip with Sophie Scomps from McKellar, joining citizen scientists who have been going out very regularly after dusk to find greater gliders' dens.
Yeah.
Greater gliders are officially endangered, and Forestry Corp is required to protect their homes, and yet the citizens are having to go out and do it because Forestry Corp survey, they just did it by day knowing that the greater gliders only come out after dusk. I mean, it just seems like it's lawless, and that actually concerned citizens have got to do the work and make sure that Forestry Corp lives up to its legal obligations. It just seems to be coming to a crunch time, and I just wonder what your concept is of how we can stop logging in native forests and avoid the loggers running off to the private forests like they have in Western Australia to just all those concepts you came up with, they all seem so relevant to how we can fix this.
Well, I think they are, Margot. Look, we do have a ways to go though, right? But nevertheless... Yeah. Nevertheless, we do have to change the way we think about these things. And importantly, we've got to find different ways of doing things. Like the Hardwood Division or Native Forest Division of Forestry Corporation of New South Wales runs at a loss, right? It's subsidised by taxpayers. It's extraordinary. Imagine that.
Our forest.
Investing in a business and not just not getting a dividend, but actually getting a negative dividend. That is, the company you're investing in requires you to write out a check to them every year just for the privilege of owning shares in them. I mean, it's just a complete nonsense. But that's where we are with Forestry Corporation in New South Wales, at least with respect to not its overall operations, not its total operations, but with respect to its native forest operations. And that, look, there is no economic system in the world in which that would be tolerated. By any rational person, but it is tolerated in Australia.
And why is that? Why is this happening? I mean, I've got my opinion. What's yours? Why is this going on?
You know, Margot, I resist this conclusion, but I can't think of any other conclusion. We are a nation that celebrates plunder. I think it's as simple as that. No, seriously, Margot, we do. And we have celebrated plunder since colonial days. And the mindsets of our leaders are no different now from what they were then. Look at the way that we celebrate the mining boom. And it's not just our political leaders, Margot. You're a journalist. You've worked for newspapers that I now read every now and again, the editor publishing things like that mining and Australian resources boom underpins Australian prosperity, right? And using this as an argument, a bit of rhetoric to make the case for why ministers like Tanya Plibersek should not stand in the way of proposals for new mines, whether it's, well, any form of mining, really, whether the world needs it or not. And so I really don't know. I think it's part of our ethos, Margot. You would have hoped that we would have grown up by now, but I just don't think we have. I think it's just deeply ingrained in us that if there are natural resources there to be plundered, then plundering them has to be smart. And if you look at the state of native forests, I guess you've got to live for a while, right? But when you get to my age, and particularly, I guess, because as a kid I had, you know, I found myself in the native forests of New South Wales a lot because, after all, my father was a timber worker. That's how he spent his career.
Yeah.
You know, I've had the opportunity to see firsthand what's happened to the state of forests across New South Wales, but particularly in this area, because this is where I grew up. I know what the Bulga State Forest looked like 50 years ago, 55 years ago. And I know that it doesn't look anything like it today.
Yeah. And it's not sustainable logging, is it? It's just...
Well, it's called sustainable logging, but it's the mathematical models that the loggers use, the forestry people use to determine whether something is sustainable or not, are not the models that an ecologist would use. They're not... Their concept of sustainability goes to the question of whether they can go on logging something forever. It doesn't go to the question of whether that forest will remain intact, offering the same biodiversity values as it did 200 years ago. And of course they can't, because just have a look. There's no way in the world the Bulga State Forest looked like that 200 years ago. No way in the world. And everybody knows it. We've got to find a way of achieving a better outcome for our forests and for the people who are presently deriving income from those native forests. Now, of course, that's not Forestry Corporation New South Wales, and it's not the taxpayers of New South Wales who are the shareholders of that corporation. But there are workers, there are people who work on contract or who work for that agency, for Forestry Corporation, who rely upon that work, those jobs, for their income. There are sawmills as well, right? Yeah. And we do have to think about a different future for those workers. And so what I've been thinking about with a group of colleagues who are in the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation that I chair, what I've been thinking about is whether there isn't a smarter way of doing this, where instead of the forests being used for logging, doing more and more damage to the biodiversity values of the forest year after year after year, whether we can't turn that around and find a way of using those same forests to store carbon, to help Australia meet its climate goals, to restore biodiversity rather than to destroy biodiversity, to incorporate Indigenous cultural practice, attend to bushfire resilience, and of course to provide or enhance the recreational values of the state forests. And you know, we asked that question of ourselves some years ago, and then we did some numbers to try to figure out, okay, if the forests were not used for logging, but were used in a different way to do the things that I just mentioned, could they generate large sums of carbon credits? And how much would those carbon credits be worth? And would they generate enough revenue to be able to fund that new model, employing at least as many people as are presently being employed? And the answer is yes.
Right.
The answer is yes, it can be done. The numbers make sense.
So if the law can change so that if, say, the New South Wales government says, right, there's no more native forest logging, these forests are protected, that is worth money as a carbon offset. But if you regenerate and it keeps growing and growing, its value gets higher and higher, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, that's right. So, well, two things. Firstly, the New South Wales government would have to, the way it behaves is rather important here, because under Australia's carbon policies that support the generation of these Australian carbon credit units, or ACCUs, landholders have to, all landholders, private landholders, public landholders, the same, they all have to satisfy what's called an additionality test. That is, the it has to be
not a taking away test.
That the, yeah, additionality test, right? So it has to be clear that anybody who's generating carbon credits in the Australian market, whether they're a public entity like a government or whether they're a private landholder, they have to satisfy an additionality test. That is, it has to be clear that the carbon that is being sequestered and generating the credit is arising because they are engaging in a carbon project, right? So,
felling wood is negative, not positive. Therefore, it can't. Therefore, if you stop negative,
it's not that.
that doesn't turn into a positive.
That's fine. No, that's fine. It's just that if the New South Wales government were to take a decision to legislate an end to native forest logging, for some reason that's not related to carbon, then that might mean that it's not capable of generating carbon credits, right? Because
couldn't you tweak the law to make it okay?
Of course there is a way of doing this, right? There is a way of doing this. And you know, the New South Wales government has steadfastly refused to end native forest logging forever, right? But what I'm hoping is that one day, and I'm hoping in the not too distant future, there is a carbon method available that would allow the New South Wales government or Forestry Corporation New South Wales to decide for themselves, well, look, we're in a different world now. There is now the possibility to use these forests for purposes other than logging. Yeah. And in particular, we could use these forests to store carbon. And as you said, as the forests get bigger and bigger, the trees get bigger and bigger, you store more and more carbon and you can generate carbon credits. And that provides an income stream that allows you to do all the other things that we talked about. So that's what I'm... That's the future that I hope to see, and I hope that that future arrives in the not too distant future. Because if we keep going on the way that we have been, we're not going to have much left to save.
Well, you know, we had devastating bushfires in 2019, and I don't know. I mean, I've been told that just before they lost the election, the coalition re-signed contracts with the mills that took no account of the loss in the bushfires. I mean, my opinion, I mean, it's pretty standard, is that, you know, these are National Party seats and they're politically protecting the logging mills and the contractors, and Labor won't do anything because the CFMEU's got workers there. So it's just this thing that, you know, I just go, well, come on, how about a transition plan?
Yeah.
You know, how about generous severance? I know some loggers would like to do regen. I know some like to be in their big, you know, their big machines, but you can give them a big severance. I mean,
we do know that it can be done. And by the way, we're going to have to do a lot more of this in the years ahead. If we do not act with sufficient urgency to deal with climate change and to deal with nature repair, we're going to have much, much bigger problems than this, I can tell you.
Yeah.
We're going to have much greater loss of livelihood than what's being talked about here. And even worse, right? And so the point here is that we should be intelligent about this. We've got the time to do it now. If we act now, we can deal with those transitional issues, right? I think we can be smart about this, Margo. We know what the challenge is. We know that there is a transition that has to occur, and we should be smart enough to ensure that it's a just transition.
Yes.
That people whose livelihoods are being impacted in the interests of the greater good, and that's what we're talking about, the greater good here, that those people who are having their lives impacted, that they be compensated for that, or, you know, even better than compensation, that they have an alternative employment opportunity that's at least as good as the one that they presently enjoy. And that has to be the task here. And I think that if the government were to indicate that it was interested in these transitions, I think you would find communities getting together, community by community, right up the east coast of New South Wales, and figuring out how to do this.
Yeah. So you'd like to do it on a community basis? Because I was sort of thinking, you know, after my arrest, thinking, oh, you know, what on earth is going on? Like, maybe this Nature Summit, trying to bring private philanthropy and business and government together. Maybe we should just set up a GoFundMe for the transition. Yeah. And yeah, if you're rich and you put in enough money, you can have one of the saved forests named after you. I mean, what a legacy. Just shame them into it. I mean, we've got to start getting creative, because the front line's exhausted, and the people trying to change the system, it's very slow. And I noticed Tanya said during her speech, I'll just get it up, we are at the start of the road when it comes to nature positive and turning things around. Our job is not just to do the work, but to take others along with us, to build coalitions with unlikely allies as well as our traditional partners. Now, what she's saying is that she's politically powerless to act, that there has to be a shift somewhere. So I just, wonder if that wild idea is
maybe we've got to do both, right? Maybe we've got to do a lot of things, right? But I do think it's very important to have the engagement of local communities. And one reason I say that is that we've got to get genuine involvement from First Nations people as well, right? From Indigenous people as well. They've got to be involved. And that can only happen at the local community level. So I think, and in my experience, if you get people at the local community level sharing a problem, you get goodwill. Right.
Yes, but the problem in seats like ours, like seats like Lyne, is that how can I say it? There's a lot of people that think logging's a good thing. and there's not that much interest in protecting the forests.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like, Elands in the Bulga Forest is a very particular thing. It's full of environmentalists, you know, who are there because they love their forest.
Yeah. Sure, I know what you mean. But look, I come from a logging family. I'm the son of a logger.
Mm.
He would be distressed to see the state of the Bulga State Forest today.
Yeah,
he would be absolutely distressed. And not just him, but his brothers that he worked with, they would be equally distressed. They didn't expect that this was what was going to happen to these forests.
Yeah. So the CFMEU, like, how many people of their people would be involved in logging in New South Wales, do you reckon?
No, I don't. I don't know. I don't know, Margo. But
surely if you sort of said to them, look, what would be something that your members would be happy with as a severance and as a retraining opportunity? Surely they could come to the party and they could extend their union to bush regenerators or something. I don't know, but it just seems like this stuckness, it just keeps staying stuck. It's not moving, and people have got to go, like me, have got to go and log on to harvesters and, you know, nearly have a nervous breakdown, and people who are 75 have got to go down. It just doesn't seem that anything is allowed to happen.
I do think that we do have to involve the unions at the same time as we involve local communities. But I do think on the basis of the discussions I've been having over the past couple of years with people in all sections of the industry, there is a growing realization or acceptance, really, that things have to change. Yeah. There is an understanding, and it's a pretty broadly shared understanding, that we have to change the way that we manage our native forests, that we can't assume that the jobs that we have today are going to be there in 5 years' time. And we know that's the case because look back 5 years or go back 10 years or 20 years and it's an industry, at least the hardwood bit, the native forest bit, the bit that relies on native forests, that's just it's been in decline for a very long time. I mean, across Australia, only, I don't know how many of your listeners would be aware of this, but across Australia, only about 10% of the timber that comes out of native forests ever gets to a sawmill.
Yeah, the rest is
pulped, it's chipped, it's burned as firewood. And if you look at the uses,
it's just shocking. It makes you cry. Yeah. Pallets
is tiny. It's absolutely tiny. I had somebody from the industry try to convince me one day that we couldn't end native forest logging in Australia because of the need to source Australian hardwood for pallets. So I asked CHEP how much timber they needed for their pallets, and it's tiny. It's not even a rounding error in the volume of timber taken out of Australia's native forests. So it's, forgive my language, but it's just a bullshit story, that one. And there are a lot of those around, like there's a lot of myths. But reflect on this, and people know this. Ask yourself this question. The average new house being built in Australia today, how much timber does it have in it that comes out of a native forest? Answer, approximately zero. Right? Mm-hmm. Approximately zero. Now, I'm talking to you from a farmhouse, which you've been to, Margot, and you know it's made entirely out of Australian native timbers.
Yes, right? This incredible temperate forest, yeah.
Yeah, well, rainforest, yeah. That's what this house is made out of, is rainforest timbers. And
mine too, really. So, it's a worker's cottage.
Yeah, there you go, right? And so, look, 100 years ago. Rosewood,
my God.
Yeah, 100 years ago, that's what we were making houses out of.
Yeah.
That is not what we're making houses out of today. And why? Because the timber's not there. So we know this, and we know that we've been transitioning out of this industry for a very long time. And so it's now time to ask ourselves the question, how do we do this sensibly rather than just allowing it to happen to us? Yeah. How do we take charge of this rather than just allowing it to happen to us?
So do you see a role for the front line? Because, you know, having reported this now for, you know, 1.5 years or whatever, it's local people who've got jobs. They're not big money people. They've got kids and they're just... And there's activists around, you know, New South Wales that come down and try and help. But honestly, I just feel they're running out of puff. And to me, this is absolutely crucial to delay this and to make it more expensive so that they have to come to terms with it. The biodiversity stuff is just so scandalous.
Yeah.
But how do we sort of get the front line to be stronger, do you think? Or do you think we just have to struggle along and do funny things on the ground?
No, it shouldn't be needed, right? I mean,
it is needed.
Yeah, I know, Mark. I was going to say, I used to, I spent most of my professional life thinking out of the public gaze, thinking about optimal policy reform, you know.
tax reform.
Well, that among many.
If only.
Yeah, But among many other things, you know. And
yeah.
And reflecting on how you would design an optimal policy response to various challenges, you know. And it should be possible for governments and their advisors to do that without being embarrassed into it, right, by the front line, right? And yet, you know what? And you do know this because you were around at the time. The fact is that every now and again, and maybe most of the time, governments do have to be embarrassed into acting.
Well, the Franklin, you know?
Correct. Yeah.
The northeast, the forests in the north of New South Wales that I think Bob Carr turned into national parks after incredible actions. We don't seem to be quite capable of getting that big these days, probably because everyone's got a lot of problems.
Who knows, Margot? Your contribution recently might be the thing that does it. Who knows?
It got a 75-year-old retired librarian up and a 78-year-old forest campaigner who helped create the Nightcap National Park. But, whoa. I don't know, but I just think really that the front line is the only line that is delaying, and making it more costly for them to keep doing what they're doing, and it's something that I really don't know how it can be strengthened, but let's hope, eh? Yep. It's sort of like, a lot of people in the city, they support it, but they're not going to run up and lock onto a harvester, are they? I mean,
and they shouldn't have to. And they shouldn't.
No, absolutely not. Let me tell you about it. I had a fucking nervous breakdown when I did it, and I'm never going to do it again. But
it can't be easy. It's not easy.
If there's, do you think there's any chance that? I know New South Wales government set up this forestry panel, which just looks like a delaying tactic to me, but do you think there's any chance they would be prepared to move? And is there any chance that private philanthropy could give them some assistance to do it?
I don't know about the private philanthropy, although, there are a lot of philanthropists in Australia who would see value in it, but do they have enough money to achieve what needs to be done here? I don't know. But your first question, do I see a possibility of the New South Wales government doing this, changing things, having the forest managed for carbon and biodiversity, Indigenous cultural practice and so on? Well, I do. I do. And if I didn't, I wouldn't be investing so much of my time and energy in this. I've got other things to do with my life as well, but we all do, right, Margot? We all do. But and particularly in a beautiful place like Comboy. But I really think there is an opportunity to get people of goodwill together around a table and to get this done once and for all.
Well, I'm just so grateful to you for putting, your very big brain onto this, Ken. and thank you so much for chatting. And I'll probably meet you on a spotlight sometime, hopefully. I remember last time we tried we tried to talk Sophie Scomps into doing a tree sit, and she really, really wanted to, but I don't think the politics was right.
She looked pretty enthusiastic to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, good on her. Yeah. Mm. So thank you very much. And, yeah, look, we'll both keep working on it in our own way, eh?
Good. Very good. So we should.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you for listening, and hope you enjoyed.